Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. In this episode, I am talking with Lisa Bortolotti. Lisa is philosopher and professor of philosophy at the University of Birmingham. She's also editor-in-chief of Philosophical Psychology. She has her PhD in philosophy, and many of her main interests are in philosophy of science, rational beliefs, and in epistemic injustice. And we talk about her book, Why Delusions Matter. It's out through Bloomberry, part of a series they have going on over there. And it's a fascinating book. I absolutely loved it. It made me think really, really hard on something that I've studied a lot, and obviously something I've worked with clinically. I talk about that in the conversation. It really is such a thought-provoking book, and Lisa is just absolutely lovely. She's super brilliant. Really, really enjoyed my conversation with her. We talk all about delusions. We talk about why we should think about delusions. Delusions as emotional and as rational beliefs. We give a definition of delusions. We spend a good amount of time on clinical versus non-clinical delusions. I give a little bit from my perspective of the clinical side of this, and having worked with various patients over my career and my day job, and where those converge. And she obviously holds it down on the non-clinical philosophical side, and where those two converge, if you will, and where they meet is absolutely fascinating. It was just a fun part of the conversation. And we talk about why we believe delusions. We talk about when delusions can cause harm. Can people change their delusional beliefs? And many other topics. Again, this was such a blast. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. It really is a conversation where we're kind of pulling and picking at certain ideas and tossing them around. And she was just absolutely wonderful. And so definitely get her book. It's really, really quite brilliant. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. To get over there, like, follow, subscribe, share with your friends. And contribute if you like. All that is much appreciated. And now I bring you Lisa Bortolotti. I am here with Lisa Bortolotti. Lisa, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I greatly respect your work and the book that you've written that we're going to talk about. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks for asking me.
Yes, of course. So before we get into the book, which is called Why Delusions Matter, which is, I think this is through a series, right, of this Why Philosophy Matters series, correct?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, and that's through Bloomsbury. Why don't you tell listeners who you are professionally, academically, and what you're currently thinking about and researching?
Yes, of course. So I'm a professor of philosophy, and I work at the University of Birmingham in the UK. And my main areas of interest are the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of psychology and psychiatry. So I'm mostly interested in what we do when we make decisions, when we reason, whether, you know, we're ever kind of rational in doing that, what kind of impact our emotions might have, but also the environment surrounding us. So other people and the places we are, the influences we are under. In general, that is what has always interested me, both in cases where, you know, we're just trying to go around our usual everyday tasks and interacting with people in an ordinary way, but also in those cases where things seem to be going badly wrong. So when, you know, to other people at least, it looks as if we are not in our right mind or something is wrong with us. So I'm really interested in what happens there and what we can do to better understand that. I'm fully aware that it's the kind of project that cannot be done by one type of researcher or one type of academic alone. It requires, you know, psychology, social sciences, maybe psychiatry, or anyway, mental health research. And I think philosophy brings all of them somehow together. So yeah, that's what interests me.
No, that's wonderful. I mean, philosophers are always such wonderful people to talk to, because it's a lot of, you know, thinking outside of the box and trying to really have, you know, questions that are important. And especially for things in our everyday life, you know, it's a lot of people think of philosophers as, you know, just people that sit around and read Aristotle or Immanuel Kant, which is, you know, I'm sure many do, and that's great, but you know, philosophy impacts our daily lives often. And so to think philosophically, I think is important. So I guess I'm going to ask you the first question, which is the title of the book. So why do delusions matter? Obviously we'll talk about what delusions are and what they aren't and, you know, all of these things, but I guess the really general question is why is this a question to begin with? Right. And that's not some kind of tautology or something like that. Right. That's a real kind of thing of like, why should we think about this? Right. Why is it important to think about, probably by proxy belief, but you know, certain types of beliefs or delusions or things like that. Why is this something that is important to consider?
It's a very good question, because thinking about the way in which philosophical ideas evolve, the interest of philosophers in delusion is relatively recent. Mm. So, of course, you know, Freud was talking about delusions, and people were talking even before him about what happens when we get things wrong. But delusions as such, as a symptom of a mental health issue, are something that have grabbed the philosophers' attentions maybe in the last 30 years. And I think it's a combination of factors, like the science of delusions getting a bit more interesting, more detailed. So psychologists coming up with specific theories about what is it that our brain and perceptual mechanisms do or don't do properly when we have delusions. But also this fundamental idea that many the philosophers used to have, and many philosophers still have, that the moment in which we try to understand reality and represent how things are through beliefs, we have to assume that we're doing it in a rational way. There is at least something rational about us if we are engaged in that kind of exercise. And delusions undermine very strongly that idea. At least they were thought to undermine very strongly this idea. So delusions seem to be a perfect example of a situation where we are trying to represent reality, we are trying to engage with the world around us, but we don't seem to exhibit the level, the even minimal level of rationality that we would expect to have in that circumstance. So that's the first answer to the question. So delusions matter because they force us to ask an uncomfortable question about how is it that we can try to make sense of the world without seemingly conforming to basic standards of rationality. The question that interested me more is a different one. I think that delusions matter because they force us to think in new ways, in novel ways, about what happens when we interact with people we deeply disagree with. Mm. And by deeply disagree, I mean, it's not just a disagreement about a question that can be settled by, you know, waiting for a bit of new evidence, right? It's a question of disagreement that involves our values, what we care about, how we want to live our lives, and so on. So I think delusions really force us to think carefully about what happens when we are interacting with people that very often we don't even fully understand. And I think that in recent years, I mean, there have always been disagreements, of course, but in recent years, we have become all a little bit more aware of how difficult it is to overcome a crisis when people cannot unite, cannot try and work together because they have deep disagreements of values. Mm. And so all the, you know, debates that we know very well about polarization and so on. And I think delusions bring us back to that very basic idea, you know, what am I going to do if I face someone who looks like me, you know, who should be thinking like me, but actually, you know, we can't understand each other. We can't make any progress.
It's very interesting. I like the emphasis on these different types of ways of thinking or delusions matter because it forces us to think about things differently and in different ways, which is certainly true. There's a lot of hard questions here. So one at a time, I guess. I guess the one thing here is that you're describing this emphasis on rationality and on logic. Now, is that to say that if you hold delusional beliefs or delusional thinking, that it's more emotive, right? That there's an impulsivity, there's an emotionality to it. Now, I don't think that's what you're saying, but I think that's someone listening to this could say, well, wait a minute. If it's this suspension or it's a difference at the least of rational thinking or logic or reason or truth finding, then does that mean that it's just emotional? And I'm not trying to make this a false dichotomy, but where do you find if there's some delusions that is problematic in terms of logic or reasoning, where then does that sit, right? Does that sit in another type of reasoning? Does it sit in some kind of emotionality? Where does that kind of thinking, I guess, sit is my question.
Yeah, it's a very important question. So as you know, both in philosophy and in psychology, there has been a very long-standing dichotomy, you know, deep distinction between the cognitive and the affective. So the cognitive characterized maybe by beliefs intended by representations of reality. And when you're thinking about the relationship between beliefs, you're thinking about reasoning and inference, and you can do that well, you can do it that badly. When you do it well, you are rational. And that's why it is interesting that you use the word logic, because, you know, logical relations have a role to play in that particular context. And then there is the affective, which is mainly about emotions. And emotions are not really about representing the world, they're about our reaction to the world. And so there is almost no logic to them, apart from maybe kind of, you know, an adaptive function. So if we are scared because there is a lion, we run away. So the emotion has this kind of role of making us flee a potentially dangerous situation and so on. So there is a logic to them, but it's not the same type of logic. Both in philosophy and in psychology, this dichotomy is fading, and the line between beliefs and emotions has been blurred for some time. Mm-hmm. Because we have all realized that actually belief without emotion is useless, and similarly, emotions represent the world just as much as beliefs mm-hmm. do. So philosophers have started talking about the rationality of emotion. Mm-hmm. And of course, it makes sense when you think about it. What is a phobia, right? A phobia is a fear that is not appropriate to the circumstances. So it's just an irrational type of fear mm-hmm. and so on. So you can think about standards of rationality for emotions as well. So you are absolutely right in your probing question that it would be a mistake to think that because delusions are not considered to be rational beliefs, then they fall into the domain of emotion. Mm-hmm. But there is a lot of philosophical literature that argues a little bit along those lines. You know, the thought is, oh, they cannot be beliefs because they are not rational enough. Maybe they look like beliefs, so they are apparent beliefs or seeming beliefs, but they're really something else. You know, so some people have argued, for instance, that delusions are acts of imagination that the person mistakenly considers beliefs. And the advantage of that view is obvious, right? Because if you think that it's an act of imagination, it doesn't need to follow any particular rational standard. You can imagine whatever you like, you know, even impossible things. But then, of course, you've got the problem of justifying how is it that a delusion seems to be related to what the person does and to how the person feels. Right. In a way in which acts of imagination sometimes aren't. Like if I'm imagining something really scary, I may be a little bit scared, but not really scared, right? Because I know I'm imagining it. So I think that delusions are beliefs through and through. So, you know, whatever applies to any form of belief is very likely to apply to delusions as well, which doesn't mean that they are, you know, exclusively in the domain of the cognitive. Because, of course, beliefs are influenced by our emotions and they cause emotional reactions in us. But I think there is no distinction in the sense rational belief is cognitive, irrational belief is something completely different. I think what may be true in the case of some delusions, for instance, delusions that emerge in the context of something like schizophrenia, is that there is a very strong perceptual component. So the person has an experience, which is very often an experience that is unusual. And that experience drives the belief very strongly. Now, there are other forms of beliefs that are not delusions that are driven by our experiences, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think in the case of some delusions, that's very, very evident. Like you hear a voice, even if you don't see anybody around you. Suppose that's an auditory hallucination of some kind caused by your illness. And you are very strongly led to believe that there is someone because you have had that experience. So there is a very strong relationship between the experience, which could be emotionally laden, of course, and the belief.
So, yeah, I like how you kind of detail that. And I think that there's some interesting things about that. So we're kind of leading to this idea of how we define delusion. So we should probably do that now. So how do you define delusions generally? I would just say that just as a general, someone asks you, you know, define delusion, right? Well, what are delusions? How would you define it? But probably what will be more, you know, productive here is I like the split that you make in the book about these kind of two categories, right? Now, of course, people can have various taxonomical differences about how they organize these things, but I do think a very simple way is there's this clinical and this non-clinical way of looking at delusions, which I think is important, right? And so we can talk about that. But so just how do you define delusions generally? And then you can talk about the two categories you put out there.
Yes. So that's probably the most difficult question that I'm going to answer tonight. So it's good that we get it out of the way sooner rather than later.
People, I've realized this as I've gotten older. Most arguments and most disagreements and most things that are difficult in that way are just disagreeing about how we define things. All the biggest questions I think of life are just like, well, I see it this way and you see it that way, or I define it. That's not my definition. That's your definition. I find a lot of these arguments really come down to that, which is very interesting. Yeah. But go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So as you know, in the literature, you find a huge variety of definitions of delusion. I guess a definition is useful for a specific purpose. So like if you're in the business of diagnosing, for instance, mental disorders, you will have a definition of delusion that enables you to recognize whether the patient in front of you has a delusion or not. In other contexts, you may not be interested in identifying, you know, a specific belief as a symptom of illness. You might just be interested in making a distinction between a belief of someone that you should listen to from a belief of someone that you should just dismiss and ignore. So depending, you know, what you want to do with the notion of delusion, you might prefer one definition over another. So the standard account is that delusion is an irrational belief that is different from other irrational beliefs because it is sometimes particularly unusual in content and because it's very resistant to counter-evidence or counter-arguments, which means that the person who has the delusion doesn't easily give up the belief, even if there are what seems at least to other people to be convincing challenges against the belief. Mm. Now, I don't particularly find this a useful definition for two reasons. First of all, I think we are overly impressed, but by the irrationality of delusions and the fact they are resistant to counter-evidence. They are often irrational and resistant to counter-evidence, but not to an extent that enables us to distinguish them from other beliefs that are not delusional. So I think we are making too much of those two features. And secondly, you know, with that definition, we'd really struggle to distinguish delusion from other things that we care about that we don't normally think are delusional, such as acts of confabulation, acts of self-deception. You know, they all seem to fit that particular definition quite well. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to do in the book, and that is under pressure, you know, from people, because they kept saying, you know, you work on delusion and you have to have a definition of delusion. So in the book, I try to come up with some features to do a better job at actually singling out delusion from other types of beliefs that we might be interested in. And the way I do it is by thinking that delusions are not necessarily false, but implausible, that they are resistant to counter-evidence in the sense that it's difficult to shake them off, so they're unshakable in some respect, and that they are the type of belief that, you know, other people will kind of not share and challenge and sometimes even find dangerous. I think that's quite interesting. Like, delusion is not neutral, right? When we're saying that something is a delusion, we are making a negative judgment against it. And sometimes the negative judgment doesn't refer merely to the irrationality of the belief. It refers to what the belief can do that is damaging.
The effect or the impact of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's do this. So on the clinical and non-clinical side, let's talk about the clinical side for a minute, because that's a little bit in my world. So it's I know a little bit more about this. So I was very interested, and then we can obviously talk about the non-clinical side. But let's just have as the clinical side kind of our sort of baseline of sorts, right?
Yeah.
And then we can talk about how it looks another way. So I would say in both cases, in both cases, there's a potential effect for the person that is believing the delusion and the person that it's impacting, right? And there is a reason. Now we can, I have much disagreements with both APAs, American Psychiatric and American Psychological Associations. Totally fair. I have much disagreements with the DSM-5 TR, the current version. So that being said, you know, there is a way in which, as we try to give a kind of framework, you know, typically we look at things that are disorderly in terms of pathology, right?
Yes.
Things that are maladaptive, right? Things that are out of the ordinary, things that can cause harm or things that cause disruption, typically in ways that are the general phrases that are used are significant impairment, you know, consistent and pervasive, you know, things like that. So for example, you know, because, you know, and this is where all of the timelines become important and many of these things. So, you know, the reason we don't just say if you, you know, let's say have a kind of, you know, unpopular opinion or belief, and that's about it. Well, that's not going to be enough to say that you have delusional disorder or type of psychosis. And that's very important, because my opinion and my view is, I think we over-pathologize things in many ways. Another way of this is, I think a downside of destigmatizing mental health issues is that we over-pathologize things more because we have them as more acceptable. So that's a whole debate. And there's another branch to that, which is there are many people that are suffering, or they have some type of pain, or they have some type of distress, but they don't have a disorder, right? So you can think about what we would say non-pathological anxiety, right? People or non-clinical anxiety. Maybe they don't have generalized anxiety disorder or sociophobia or separation anxiety, but they still have effects of being anxious that is more than just I'm anxious for a test, or I'm anxious for my job interview or whatever. It is pervasive, but not enough to meet qualifications for disorder. That can be accurate and be true, but it doesn't mean that this person shouldn't have treatment as well. And that's a whole other problem, because in, you know, managed care doesn't, you need a label, you need a diagnosis. So there's a whole problem there. Anyways, so back to, I guess, delusions. So I'll read the definition clinically. This is out of the DSM. So is a false belief based on incorrect inference about external reality that is firmly sustained, despite what almost everyone else believes and despite what constitutes incontrovertible and obvious proof or evidence to the contrary. The belief is not one ordinarily accepted by other members of the person's culture or subculture, such as article or religious faith. And when a false belief involves a value judgment, it's regarded as a delusion only when the judgment is so extreme as to defy credibility. Now, you have many wonderful points as to why this definition has problems, which, and I agree with many of them. I will say, generally, the point of the definition, from my understanding, is they're trying to make a kind of categorical kind of, this is pathological and this is not. This is pervasive, extreme, severe, and this is not. So when you take something like, so in the DSM, there's a, what we know now is, or excuse me, how we frame it, our taxonomy now, is we use things on a kind of multidimensional scaling of things, meaning that things fall in a continuum. And many people know this with autism, right? We took out Asperger's and we have autism on a spectrum, right? Well, we decide now that psychosis is kind of on a spectrum as well, right? Not exactly in the same way as autism, but that is, we call them schizophrenia and other psychotic disorders, you know, schizophrenia spectrum, things like that. And for schizophrenia, you need two or more of five categories. So it is like quite possible, although I believe rare, to have schizophrenia and not have hallucinations or delusions, right? Or you think you can have one of them, but you can, many times you don't see hallucinations. So hallucinations can be auditory, visual, tactile, etc. Needs to be within 6 months and pervasive for a year, on and on and on. And then you have something called delusional disorder, right? And delusional disorder is where you have to have one or more delusional beliefs for at least a month. Now, I won't get into all the details of this, but there are interesting specifiers, right? Which is very interesting, right? So we can kind of go further on this. So there's seven or eight. So there's erotomanic type, right? So this is when it applies, where the theme of the delusion is that another person is in love with the individual. You have grandiose type, where the central theme of the delusion is the conviction of having some great talent or insight or some important discovery. Jealous type, which is where the individual's delusion is that their spouse or lover is unfaithful. Persecutory, where they believe that someone is being conspired against, cheated, spied on. Somatic, has to do with bodily functions or sensations. And then you have mixed type. So there's a mixture of these, unspecified, you can't really put in a category, and some with bizarre content. Now, of course, you can break these down other ways. These are the ways of pathology. And the real thing with the subtypes is just trying to say clinically, okay, what are some of these groupings that we see? So you could say someone has delusional disorder, but, you know, if there's a sort of general theme of the delusion, maybe it fits into one of these subtypes, or it's mixed, or it's unspecified, et cetera. It's more of a way of trying to classify. So the question I have here is, in the clinical world, how do we have a kind of framework of understanding delusions that are, if somebody has beliefs or they have delusional beliefs that we would categorize as delusional beliefs, I think the thing that becomes difficult is, how does people around them kind of parse out this way of, well, how true or untrue that is? So if, and then also, how is it that this person is feeling or interacting. Because for the person that believes it, we're saying that it's demonstrably untrue that, you know, this person is in love with a famous actress or something like that. That's just obviously not true, or that, you know, somebody's out to get them. And this is not true. But they believe it as real as I believe the sun comes up in the morning. But it's not true. And so there's this emphasis on truth, or how do we, you know, how things are false or not. In a clinical setting, how do we understand how delusions work, right? How delusions matter to the person, those around them, in a clinical space versus a non-clinical space, right? Because we can talk about conspiratorial thinking. We can talk about many other things with delusions in a non-clinical world. But for you, in your opinion, how do you understand the kind of landscape of delusions in a clinical world and how to kind of interact with them? So I'm very curious for your thoughts here.
Yeah. No, I think it's very useful that you gave this kind of background. I think it's necessary for the discussion. And I said earlier that, you know, we can have different definitions of things because we have different roles that we want to play. And, you know, depending on what we want to do with the definition, we may need, you know, definitions are things for us. You know, they need to be useful for us. So very often the DSM definition is very useful. I think it is a very useful definition. Yeah. And it is more sophisticated than sometimes people concede, because, you know, it's not easy, for instance, to be able to say, how do I distinguish a religious belief from a religious delusion? Okay, the definition is trying to give some clues about that. It's not easy to know what is it to be supported by evidence, or what it is to have the right inferential connections with the other things that we believe. And the definition is trying to do that. So it's a useful definition in a clinical setting when we're trying to understand whether actually this is something I should worry about or not. But the emphasis on the delusion being false, I think, is unhelpful. It is unhelpful because, as you know, very rarely, but it happens, delusions happen to be beliefs with true content.
Yeah.
The most common circumstance, talking to people who have a lot of clinical experience, is actually the delusion of jealousy. Mm-hmm. So many people who think that, you know, their spouse, for instance, is having an affair, they believe it for the wrong reasons. They believe it in a way that is not helpful to them, or is not even healthy in many circumstances. But it may actually be true that the spouse has an affair. And there are some really interesting case studies of people who were thought to be, you know, to be having delusions of jealousy because the clinical team didn't know the circumstances of the person. And it turned out that their partner had actually left them for someone else. So what do we say at that point? Do we say it's no longer a delusion? Or do we say that it is a delusion because it is believed in certain specific ways? The quality of a delusional belief sometimes is quite different from the quality of another belief. And still, it can happen to be true. And similarly, you know, you did talk about the delusions of persecution. And I think that it's very important to talk about them because sometimes philosophers avoid talking about them. But they are among the most common, even in schizophrenia, not just in delusional disorder. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And really interesting studies about delusions of persecution show you that although that particular belief may be false, like nurses are trying to poison me, very often in the past experience of the person who has delusions of that type, there are adverse circumstances where they have been persecuted. So right. Bullying, for instance, in childhood, sexual abuse in childhood are all risk factors for paranoia, for instance, paranoid delusions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm not saying that the delusion is true, because it's not. But I'm saying that it does say something interesting and not completely false about the person's experience. That in their experience, other people didn't mean well, didn't try to protect them, but actually try to harm them. And this can happen again, right? So I think the emphasis on falsehood is to some extent understandable in a context in which you have to make quick decisions in a diagnostic setting. But at the same time, it doesn't give us the kind of complexity and depth that we need. There is something wrong with a belief that is described as delusional, but it's not necessarily the content being false. And so that's, I think, the thing that sometimes worry us about the DSM definition.
Okay, so let me jump in here and ask this. So, but it is pointing to something in terms of, I think the thing that is most, this is a little tricky. It is pointing to thought process. And that's what we're concerned about, right? We're concerned about thought process that is too, potentially harmful for the person or other people around them, right? So if I'm maneuvering in the world and I think behind every stoplight there's cameras, there are cameras on stoplights, but you know what I mean, that there's a concerted effort that people are watching and following me, and there's this kind of persecutory belief or other types of things. I agree with you. I agree that yes, it does turn out that sometimes people are right, or sometimes it's not even that they're fully right, that they're right in a small way, or 20% they were right, but they were wrong in the 80%. Fine. So I do agree that it is a kind of, I understand why the language is that way, but I don't agree. I'm more on your side of this of yes, saying that it's a false belief, you know, isn't really helpful entirely, but it doesn't mean that the thought patterns or the thinking is lucid, cohesive, or I guess you could say helpful for the person in, you know, promoting flourishing and well-being and growth and things like that, where we would say that this does impact their other components of who they are as a person. A footnote here, in I want to make a distinction between, because there's an interesting thing about this connection between thoughts and beliefs is where I find delusion works, as opposed to thoughts and speech, where there's one of the criteria for schizophrenia is disorganized speech, which is also pointing us to thought processes, but in a more physiological or organic way of if your speech is very odd or strange, they're saying that there's some kind of connection with the kind of wiring of how we're thinking. Thinking and beliefs is a little bit more abstract. I would say a little bit more frontal, a little bit more, taking certain social aspects, maybe even theory of mind, et cetera. Beliefs are in different parts of the brain, usually more, you know, frontal areas, usually higher order thinking as opposed to kind of the physiological aspect of speech. Either way, and I'm sure people can listen to this and say, well, if you're saying the worry is if there's parts of a belief that are maybe true or untrue is not the right way, but it's pointing to patterns of thought or how somebody's thinking about things or thinking through things. The question becomes for that, and I'm curious for your thoughts on this, is where is the line where that is pathology and not pathology? Because you can most certainly say that certain belief systems that point to a certain thinking pattern or certain ways of thinking or cycles of thinking for people that believe that the earth is still flat or that the 9/11 was an inside job or UFOs, you know, live among us, or, you know, you could say, well, how is that not pathology? But the person that is in an inpatient hospital and has delusional beliefs about his dog is, you know, a king in another planet or whatever it is, we do say that's pathology. Where is that line? Now, of course, it's not a hard line, but this is where there's this bleed over into the clinical and non-clinical aspects of delusion. Yeah. So talk about that kind of aspect.
Yeah. So I think this is really interesting where pathology lies. And as you know, there are different views about what kind of things can be pathological and what kind of things cannot be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So some people, and actually, I would say this is the dominant view in philosophy of medicine, mm-hmm. think that almost anything can be pathological. So you take an organ, or you take a pattern of behavior, or you take, any bit of me by itself can be pathological the moment that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do.
Uh-huh.
So my heart doesn't pump blood the way it's supposed to do to keep me alive and healthy. That means I've got a heart pathology, right?
Yep.
My belief formation system gives me beliefs that make me think that my husband is not really my husband, but an imposter. And my belief is pathological. So I find this way of talking about pathology a bit misleading. I don't think that anything can be a pathology. I think that there is a concept of pathologies that is useful in medicine and outside of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it needs to involve the whole individual. So I think that an individual as a pathology is unwell, is unhealthy, when the individual is unable to pursue their goals and interests because of something that is happening to that person. Doesn't need necessarily to be inside them. It could be something about the relationship between the person and the environment, and so on. Now, I know not everybody agrees with this,
mm-hmm.
but if you go along with this, and I think there are advantages and disadvantages. The advantages is that you have a more kind of coherent and global view of what it is for someone to be unwell, because it is very implausible to say that someone is just mentally ill or just somatically ill. Very often mental illness includes physiological symptoms. You know, people who have delusions don't sleep well. You know, it's all related. It's always the same person. They're not different systems being pathological in independent way. So that's the advantage. The disadvantage is that the moment that you think about pathology in that way, it's much more difficult to distinguish pathology from other things that don't go well, but you don't want to call pathology, right? Which is what you were kind of hinting at the beginning, the problem with destigmatizing and pathologizing too much.
Mm-hmm.
But follow me. So if you agree with a position similar to mine, that pathology is something that concerns the person is either well or unwell, then it doesn't make any sense to call any belief pathological, because the belief is not pathological in itself. In itself, it doesn't do anything good or anything bad. It's when you put that particular belief within a person who has some other beliefs and emotions and behaviors and a life to keep together, that the belief is harmful, maybe not by itself, but in combination with a number of factors, right? So the belief that the earth is flat, or the belief that my husband is not my husband but an imposter, they're not by themselves pathological. Of course, the moment that my functioning is disrupted, and notice that the DSM definition of delusion doesn't mention disrupted functioning at all, although other psychological definitions of delusions do. But the moment, you know, I'm unable to hold my life together, then I have a pathology. And the delusion is part of it, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the delusion itself that is pathological in any more kind of deep or significant way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The delusion is part of it because it's part of me. But if you see it that way, the problem of why is it that the earth is flat is not pathological, and you know that man is not my husband is an imposter is pathological, is no longer interesting in the same way, because you know the belief that the earth is flat could be non-pathological for a person who believes lots of other interesting things, is in a community where they're listened to and they're happy. It could become pathological in the context of someone who, you know, is in constant tension with their community, is not listened to, getting stressed because of this belief, and so on. What I'm trying to say is that the context really matters. And so we need to know a lot more about one particular belief before we can tell whether it is part of a pathology or not.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think context it matters, obviously. I would couple along with that, you know, the audience or who are the players involved in the context. Just as a kind of a note there, yes, inherent in the definition of delusions, there isn't about, what was the word you used? What did you use? Not impairment, that it affects your life. I forget the word.
Yeah, disrupted functioning.
Disrupted, yeah. Yes, not inherently in the definition, but if you have, let's say, delusional disorder, one of their criteria is definitely when you have schizophrenia, is that it causes significant impairment in daily functioning and social, occupational, or educational functioning. It is interesting. I don't have it in front of me, but I could be mistaken on this, so I don't hold me to it, but there are some occasions, and I think it's this one, I'm fuzzy at this at the moment, where delusional disorder does not have to cause necessarily impairment in one's life to have the disorder. I have to check on that, but there's a few exceptions for some disorders where, such as bipolar 2, you know, a hypomanic episode does not have to cause necessarily a significant impairment. So there's some strange criteria in there. But needless to say, for many, such as in schizophrenia, yes, I mean, if you have one of those symptoms, such as delusional, it does have to cause harm or impairment or, you know, just, you know, distract you to your life. So when we're thinking then, I think the context piece is important here. Well, you're kind of saying, I guess, as a kind of first piece here, that inherently or innately, delusions in and of themselves aren't necessarily, it's not that they're just super bizarre or that they're true or false, but you're saying that they have to live somewhere for them to kind of take on these sort of roles or these, they put on if they are or not. Is that based on the context? Is that somewhat of what you're saying?
Yeah. I think maybe it's not as implausible as it might sound. If you think about, I don't know, kind of, it's not politically correct these days, but like, you know, you find a tribal community that has been isolated from the rest of the world in an island. Uh-huh. And there are a group of people as part of that community who believe they can heal, you know, with their prey or with their dancing or, you know, some of these beliefs, you know, maybe things that we would consider delusional in other circumstances. But they are happy. Their community is happy. You know, everybody trusts them. They're not seen as ill or crazy, or, you know, what they do is not seen as harmful. So in that particular context, you know, the belief doesn't play a pathological role and it doesn't attract a judgment of pathology. But it's a very specific context, right? So what I'm trying to say is that I think there have been letters to medical journals where clinicians have written, you know, I've got a problem. I've got someone who is clearly delusional, comes up with the strangest things, but he's happy. I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Should I section him? Should I let him go? Should I tell someone about it? You know, the real clinical dilemmas, you know, what he says is crazy, but he's not harming anybody, not even himself. What am I going to do with that? So I think those kind of cases are not so uncommon and they make you think, you know, is that the delusion itself that is causing all this trouble? Or is it when it's combined with other things, right? Because we see a lot of comorbidity, even in schizophrenia, with depression. With other things. Mm-hmm. And so there is this big question. I mean, I have no doubt in the world that there are some delusions which are harmful in themselves. I'm thinking about like delusion of guilt, where you think, you know, you're the worst thing that happened in the world and you harm yourself because of that. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing, I can see mm-hmm. that immediate effect of the delusion is a behavior that is harmful for the person themselves. Mm-hmm. But in many other cases, I don't see this immediate, you know, drama caused by the delusion. I see a whole situation that is complicated, a whole situation that we can call pathological, and the delusion is part of it. Mm-hmm. It seems as if sometimes we have double standards, right? So there are things that are obviously not based on evidence and they're obviously departing from reality, but we tolerate them. We sometimes even respect them. We even kind of make them part of our lives. And then there are some other things that are exactly the same from the point of view of not being based on evidence and departing from reality. And we pathologize them and we take the people who believe those things and lock them up or stop listening to them, right? So what does that depend on? It's not rationality. because from the perspective of epistemic rationality, which is about the relationship with evidence, they are not different. It's something else, right? It's something else. So one thing that we don't like is uncertainty.
Right.
So you were saying, and I'm totally with you there, I think about this many times a day. Science doesn't have all the answers, but I'm happy to wait.
Right.
You know, I'm not going anywhere soon.
Me too.
Right? You know, of course, you know, if there is a virus that kills thousands of people, I'd like the treatment or the vaccine to be available sooner rather than later. But I cannot expect, you know, miracles, because science is not in the business of making miracles. But not everybody is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And tolerance to uncertainty is extremely tricky. And I think it is one of the main reasons why we have delusions and why we have conspiracy theories and why we have certain types of religious beliefs. We don't like the gaps. Some of us don't like the gaps. Mm. We find them stressful. We find them anxiety-inducing. We much prefer to have an explanation, as crazy as it might seem to other people, than not to have an explanation at all. Because having an explanation makes us feel at least a little bit more in control than not having it. The other thing that I think is really important is we don't like things we don't expect. We don't like surprising events. We don't like people who do things that, you know, we couldn't have predicted. We find that unsettling. So when there is a crisis, we see conspiratorial thinking increasing. When we see that, you know, there is a problem that we cannot solve, delusions also can be triggered. We also see that, you know, when people don't do what we expect them to do, the idea is there's something wrong with them. It's not, I don't have imagination, or I don't know enough to know why they're doing what they're doing. Is there something wrong with them, right? So I think the problem is that very often, you know, people who have an organized religion, we know what they are likely to do. We know how religions more or less work. We don't find that strange or unsettling. But, you know, someone comes home and says, you know, I think there are aliens disguised as people who are following me around. And we think, okay, I cannot cope with this. This is not the type of information that I know how to react to. Let's go to a psychiatrist. Now, it may be that let's go to the psychiatrist is the right thing to do anyway. I'm not saying, right, that we shouldn't give medical attention to people who are unwell if they are unwell.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is that the judgment that something is pathological as opposed to just a little bit weird is a judgment that depends on our culture, what we are used to, on the familiarity of these things. And in the book, I have this example, which I know I've made many times in writing before, but I think it's important. Prejudiced beliefs against other people are just as implausible and as unshakable as clinical delusions. Mm. To say things like women are bad at maths or bad at logic or they can't do politics is not less crazy than saying, you know, maybe that's not my husband, that's an imposter. It's just that we're not used to the Capgras delusion, but we are very used to sexism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have lived with it for forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I think it's important to ask ourselves this question, because it's easy to just take things as they are and say, oh, that's how it is.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, why is it that we're having double standards? Is a really interesting question. And very often prejudice beliefs are as harmful, and some type of religious beliefs too, as harmful as delusions, sometimes even more harmful.
Mm.
So, you know, it's not even a question of what the effect is. It's really how used we are to it and whether we can, in some way, understand where they're coming from. So the delusion, I think, is deeply unsettling for the listener, not necessarily for the person who has the delusion. Because it comes out in such a way that we don't know, you know, what to do with it. We can't really think very easily where it could be coming from. And we need to educate ourselves to know better, to understand better why people are coming from. Because I think in that way, you know, interaction is never going to be easy. Interaction is never going to be easy, but it's going to be possible. You know, there are things that we can do to communicate and trying to understand, but we need to have more knowledge of what situation we are in.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. But I guess there's this thing about like harm, right? If delusions cause harm to the person, right? Or they cause harm to others. And I do think, you know, a very good example of this was a lot of the bullshit that went around during the pandemic, right? I've said this plenty of times, so this won't be a new thing, but I think it's perfectly fine if I take the charitable view of things to ask questions. It's perfectly fine to look at data points. It's perfectly fine to have a healthy skepticism of institutions and of health organizations, et cetera. All of that is fair game. That is all fair. But it's like, in my mind, doing that in July of 2020 was the wrong time to do all of those things, right? If you have, it wasn't even just, you know, it's like, it's not even like if your house is on fire. It's like if your whole city's on fire, you're not going to be like, you know, we should probably fix that hole in the road. Why don't we do that? Why aren't we thinking about that right now? Right? Or, right, my house is on fire, but you know what? Oh, I really need to change that light bulb right now. Because if it doesn't, you know, it could cause a fire actually, you know? So I should probably change that light bulb. And that's kind of the equivalent of what we were doing, right? Or some people were doing that, right? Many people were not. And I don't know. I think that delusional thinking sometimes can be harmful. And I don't know. I've thought about this a lot. I don't know how to handle that. I don't know how to handle that in reality, right? Obviously, giving supporting evidence or other evidence, or here's my facts and here's your facts, right? Well, you know, here's my papers and did you read this paper, right? You know what I mean, right? You've heard this, right? You know, or here's my authority on this, right? And here's you know, your authority. You know, people are going to have their own set of things here. But I wonder if there's a way of handling that is making sure your arguments are better, making sure the data is better. And I don't normally advocate for this. But I wonder if there's a little bit of, you could call it, you know, healthy shame, right? Of saying, listen, totally fine. I hear what you're saying, but not appropriate. That's not okay. We're not going to do this right now. That's not censorship. You can do whatever you want. You can say whatever you want, but it doesn't mean that you need to get a space to hear that. We don't listen to that. We don't do that now because this is going to be problematic for many, many people. Many people are going to die. Millions of people are going to die if we keep telling people they shouldn't take vaccines or pointing out the five people that, you know, had a blood clot or whatever, right? Which happens with every single vaccine that, you know, is ever made. You know, so on and so forth. And so I just wonder sometimes as a society, and of course, you know, internet and social media and things like that, you know, definitely put this like, you know, on speed, but how do we handle when delusional thinking? I mean, let me just give one quick example on this. We know conclusively vaccines do not cause a neurodevelopmental disorder such as autism. That we know that at this point in history, we knew that 3 years ago, and we knew that 25 years ago. That's this chapter book closed. We know that. Like that's been solidly disproven. And yet that still keeps coming up. That still keeps coming up. We know that story of what happened, of how it was fraudulent, all these things, and it still keeps coming up. And that's harmful. That's actually harmful for children to not get vaccines because, I mean, maybe some ignorance there is, you know, if parents really don't know or, you know, they heard it and they just didn't do all this, they would be worried. And I understand that. But there's so many people or other people that were getting, you know, measles or things like that, or, you know, a measles outbreak or whatever. How do you think we interact or how do you think we can be conversant with people where counterfactual or counter evidence isn't always going to work, and kind of what you were saying earlier with context, there's potential harm. There's potential harm to many people. How do we interact with that? What's our rubric here of how we try to engage with folks like this?
Yeah, no, that's a very difficult question to answer, because you can study the phenomena many years and you can kind of get into a lot of details about how beliefs of a certain type get accepted and how they become so resistant to counter evidence, to counter argument, and still not be able to offer any practical advice for those specific situations that unfortunately happen a lot and have happened a lot recently. So there are, I think, two things to say. I think from a more philosophical perspective, but also has been proved by psychologists a lot, and you mentioned it a couple of times, facts don't help. So if I'm trying to persuade you that things are in a certain way, and I do it by insisting that there is this statistical evidence that is proving my point, it's very unlikely that I will be able to persuade you on the basis of that evidence. And that's often because people do not differ just in what they believe. They differ in what they consider to be good evidence for what they believe. So suppose that you are a climate change denialist, right? And suppose that I'm trying to tell you, look, there is all this climate science. It's proving uncontroversially that the climate is changing. You will not be moved if you are a denialist, because you will probably believe that climate science is corrupted or is propaganda or is fabricating evidence. So what counts for me as really good, robust evidence that comes from authoritative sources for you is just another bit of deception, right? Possibly politically motivated as well. So it's not just the beliefs that are different. It's what we believe the good evidence for those beliefs that is different. Mm. And that makes this kind of way of interacting argument, argument from me to you, an argument for you, from you to me, not very productive. And indeed, what psychologists have found, as you know, is that when we engage in this type of argumentation and we have polarized views to start with, we end up being even more polarized at the end of the conversation.
Yeah.
So this type of exchange is actually harmful because it makes the polarization bigger. And we kind of lose respect for one another in the middle of it because we get frustrated. You know, we're not going anywhere. And the reason is that these kind of beliefs are not just beliefs about climate change or about autism or about vaccines, right? They become beliefs about ourselves. They become identity beliefs.
Yeah, of course.
We start and build a lot of what we think about ourselves in those beliefs, and we commit to them in a way that is not just a commitment to an ordinary belief about the mug being on the table, mm-hmm. right? It's not that type of belief. It becomes much more important. It becomes the way that I see the world and I see myself in relation to the world. Now, what people have tried is to go about this in a different way. So instead of doing argument on one side, argument on the other side, like the tennis match type of exchange, they've tried to think about ways in which there can be some kind of bridge building that doesn't involve argument. So one idea would be to say, you know, what is it that we have in common? You know, it may be that you deny climate change and I don't. But if there is a flood that destroys our homes, then we'll be affected by it, right? We won't be happy. So maybe, you know, when inferential processes and the cognitive side of things fails, maybe we should go back to the emotions. What is it that we have in common? What is it that we care about? Not everything is in common, because I will care for different things from the things that you care about, but there will be an overlap. So people say, try and build on that overlap. The other advice that I've heard is go for the story rather than for the argument. Mm. Try to think about why that person might have arrived at the very implausible position, at least in your eyes, it's an implausible position, right? What is it that got them there? Is it the people that they like that have these beliefs and have influenced them? You know, was there, for instance, in the case of anti-vax sentiment, was there a bad experience with medical professionals earlier in their lives that had put them off? You know, try to find an entry point and try to listen, even when things seem unacceptable to you in some respect. Because sometimes, you know, you get a sense of what is happening, very similar to what we were saying about clinical delusions. It may be initially crazy to think people are following around, you know, disguised and they're aliens and stuff. But if you've had a past where, you know, you have been persecuted, maybe, you know, a story of displacement or migration, certain things can make more sense. I mean, they're not rational all of a sudden, of course, right? But you can kind of build a story where that is a reaction that is more understandable. So try to build a little bit of understanding in that way. I mean, these are not solutions, right? I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, people change their mind and everybody gets along, because that's not what happens. But it has been found that people are much happier to consider different points of view when they are approached in this way, asked about why they think the things that they believe, rather than when they are kind of exposed to lots and lots of evidence that they may or may not appreciate anyway.
Yeah, I think the identity piece is difficult because, you know, this is why I think the argument about, because I thought this for a while too, and then I realized kind of the point you're making here is trying to counteract with people with, you know, better arguments or better rationality or better facts or things like that. And well, if I just show you the evidence, you'll believe it. When there's a point where a belief in something becomes a part of your identity, that's almost mission impossible. Because then it does become, and I think people don't realize this, I certainly didn't for a long time, when you're trying to discuss with somebody about facts, if their facts have become a part of their identity or a big part of their identity, then you are making, by posing alternative facts or other, you know, better arguments, you're attacking them as a person. Even if you are not, right? Even if you are not, it's like, look, I'm just, you know, climate change is a real thing and, you know, humans have a big contribution, blah, blah, blah. And if their whole or big part of their identity is denying that for X, Y, and Z reasons, which are important to understand, anything you say to the contrary is just going to be, well, you're attacking me because that's what I believe. And it's, we're not our beliefs, right? And I think this is on all sides of the political spectrum. This is why I think extremism on politically is poison, because it's not just because, oh, we suspend, you know, critical thinking and we're not doing good critical thinking and we just need good education and we'll be fine. No, these are our brains live inside our body, inside people with a psychology. And when we attach our emotions, our investments, when we attach our identity, when we attach our social capital, when we attach our status, that's way more than just believing some ideas. And this is what happens with religion all the time. This is what happens in politics, and this is what happens with certain types of beliefs. And I've thought about this a lot as well, and I think the identity piece makes it very depressing for trying to say, like, you know, and a lot of the times it really just needs to be, it's frustrating. The person just needs to have one or two or, you know, a handful of kind of flashpoint experiences to kind of like say, whoa, I've been thinking about this way. Wow, but this experience really kind of impacted me and I need to recalibrate a bit. It usually takes some of those moments, right? And you hear this a lot with people that have been on extreme forms of certain hate groups or people are one political extremity to the next. And it just takes a moment or a series of moments. It's not because I've never heard anybody say, you know what? My friend just came up with really good, counterfactuals. And I just one day believed him and that was it. I've never heard that story. I mean, maybe it happens, but that's usually not what's going on, right? It's because we put a lot of ourselves.
And when it happens, it's probably a trigger for something that has been developing slowly and gradually through years, probably. Because, you know, I've read some stories of people who have left conspiracy theories after being involved for many years. And when you read those pieces, it really feels like they underwent a conversion.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So much about themselves had to actually change. Mm-hmm. Apart from just the belief in the conspiracy, like they had to change the people they were associating with. They had to change lots of different assumptions about how things went historically in certain moments and so on. And it's just, it sounds extremely difficult and extremely traumatic, very similar to when people for the first time realize that, oh, maybe the belief they've been having for a long time is a delusion. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe mm-hmm. things are not like that. Mm-hmm. So it is definitely, you know, the more it is entangled with your sense of identity,
yeah.
the more difficult it is to get out of it. I think you are right that education is not enough and critical thinking is definitely not enough. But I have a little bit of optimism in the sense that, you know, when we talked earlier about becoming aware that we have certain psychological needs, right? We need a sense of control. We need this idea that we are a bit special, that we know a little bit more than other people. Or we need to develop this tolerance to uncertainty, which we don't naturally have. I think if really young people are made aware that we do have these needs. And very often the things that we believe them because we are trying to kind of cope with these needs that we have. We can probably make them more self-aware. It's not that they are not going to have strange beliefs. So it's not that they are not going to be, you know, sometimes inspired by things that are not very well founded on evidence. But there will be a more kind of self-critical and self-aware understanding that sometimes the things that we attach ourselves to are not necessarily the things that represent reality in the best possible way. They're just the things that we need at the time in order to cope with something that is stressing us or that is making us worried and so on. So, I mean, it might sound extremely utopian, but with some other philosophers who are interested in delusions and conspiracy theories, we are developing resources for young children and kind of through stories, a little bit like Aesop fables, you know, like animal characters, very short stories, where we show that like in a garden or in the forest, when something unexpected happens, some of the animals involved will end up endorsing a very implausible theory, at least implausible to the other animals in the garden. And trying to analyze, you know, what might be happening there, whether it happens to us as well in everyday situations. And, you know, I don't know whether it will be any good because we are just starting. We're going to primary schools and secondary schools and try them out. But it certainly gives rise to very interesting conversations that sometimes are not in the curriculum because this is not even critical thinking. It's not identifying biases or fallacies, right? It's just trying to think about what happens to us when we are under pressure. And whether, you know, seeking an explanation is always a good idea, but sometimes not all explanations are equal. You know, some explanations are better than others, and how we go about deciding who to believe or what explanation is best. So that's one thought. You know, it's a very kind of optimistic type of thought. And of course, you know, if it works, it won't work for a very long time. But, you know, the idea of trying to build this thing into the way in which we learn about the world, so not just learning about the world, learning about ourselves and how we react to this situation.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I was also thinking about this idea that I think a lot of the times I think we need to have a type of epistemic humility on things. And I think that a few things. I think one, I think we need to know that institutions are not static, they're dynamic. and they need to continuously be evolving and changing, not just an old guard. I think people on all sides of different political spectrums, things like that, if they felt that there was a little bit more of a kind of consistent changeover and okay, and you know, I have more of a seat at the table, if you will, people would trust institutions maybe a little bit more, that your active participation is needed. I think if there was a healthy skepticism, of course, people that just want to poke a finger in everybody's eye all the time and just, you know, be the contrarian, you know, that's not necessarily called for, but people that legitimately say, how about this? How about this? And it's legitimately considered. I think that's good. And maybe some places do that now. So when you're trying to have this kind of humility of things about your thought, I think if you have many people show that by example, that's one good thing, and hopefully good for other people to foster this kind of awareness or insight of, you know what? It's okay to say, I don't know something, or I got it wrong. And I think if we see more examples of that in positions of power, if you will, or institutions, or, you know, with teachers or with parents or with, you know, just generally creating a culture of that, that you could still be an expert or you could still be educated, but you can still say those things. I think if we saw more of that being modeled, that goes a long way long-term, because then you're creating a kind of eco space where that can be okay. That's not as much of like, oh, I can't say something that's wrong because then I'm going to be somehow, you know, inept or something, right? You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, being willing to say with that, like, yeah, I believe these things, you know, pretty firmly now, but they're subject to change, you know, based on various things, and really have that. I think that's harder, but I think kind of some of those things there. And then also, I think the social component of this is, you know, really surrounding yourselves, really make, this is hard for people because just generally we gravitate to people that think like us and look like us and, you know, have the same kind of belief systems or same upbringing or whatever. That's a kind of, you know, instinctual thing for many humans. But, you know, I think if we make a, you know, I mean, not too concentrated, but if we make a concerted effort to say, I want to surround myself with people of different ways of thinking, different backgrounds, you know, different places, and learn from that, and vice versa, you know, being able for others to learn from us. It's so hard to really stay stuck in one way because you're basically making yourself impenetrable to an echo chamber, right? Like I'm not going to have an echo chamber. I'm not just going to have a bunch of people that always agree with me or whatever. And it's fine to have some of that, but that you're always with people that will push you and challenge you and say, yeah, I don't know. That's a crazy idea, man. I don't know. Have you thought about that? Like, what do you think about this, this, and this? And it's like, oh yeah, you know what? That is kind of crazy. Yeah, I didn't think about that. And like, it's a space where you can do that. And I just think a lot of people don't do that. And this is a huge reason why I'm very anti-guilt by association thing. I think that stuff's terrible for us as a society. So, when I look at these things, I'm like, yeah, everything you said that it sounds wonderful. I think some of my ideas, you know, could be cool too, but that's what we're both talking about is, you know, culture change and societal change. And that moves in slow-mo. It goes so slow and it's so hard. But I think that those could be ways in which we could try and do that. Is there anything else that you want to say about delusions? I'll give you the final word here on delusions and why they matter.
Okay. So in the last chapter, I really talk about these things that we have discussed in the end. So what we are supposed to do, given that delusions are around and people with delusions are sometimes people that we want and we should interact with. And I guess the only thing that we haven't really touched on that much that I can just mention is that very often it is a combination of factors that cause someone to endorse a certain type of belief. And some of these factors are about themselves. So they're kind of the way they think, their style of thinking, whether they have a certain bias a little bit more accentuated than another bias, whether they've got more or less education or more or less experience in a certain domain. But the other thing that matters, that seems to matter, is the environment. And you mentioned that, you talked about echo chambers, and now sometimes it's not completely our responsibility what it is that we end up believing. Very often we don't have access to everything. And I think there is a responsibility for the scientific community as well to try and make some information more accessible, more engaging, more palatable, not just to respond with statistics and percentages, but try really to engage people a little bit more. This is already being done in various contexts, but I think it can be done more. To make certain type of information just more present, more interesting. Because one thing that maybe we haven't touched on is that sometimes the information that we are impressed by is not necessarily the one that comes with the better evidential support. It's the one that is more fun, more engaging, more intriguing, as a narrative form, maybe. Maybe it's inspiring or it makes us think. And so, you know, we know that a lot of conspiracy thinking is out there in these forms, in the narrative form, in the intriguing form, you know, there is a villain there. So why shouldn't we make other type of information available in formats that are more accessible in, to other people? So just to say that the responsibility is not always with the person who has the belief. And very often there is shared responsibility with society. And I think we do have, as you were suggesting towards the end, a real call to try and make these small changes, even if we know that they will have effects only in the very long term. But try to understand that, you know, every little bit that we do is actually important in changing the kind of environment in which we find ourselves. And enables us to at least get rid of some of the delusions that we can get rid of. Not all delusions, you know, will be something that we want to get rid of or that is easy to get rid of, but try to at least tackle the ones that have dangerous consequences.
That's very well said. The book is called Why Delusions Matter. This is part of the Why Philosophy Matters series, and is through Bloomsbury. Lisa, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. This was so much fun. It really felt like a dialogue and a conversation, which I always like. But this was a lot of fun. So I greatly appreciate you coming on and giving us your wisdom.
Thank you so much.